Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, updates from the front lines of the opioid crisis. According to the latest statistics, 2016 is on pace to top the overdose numbers from 2015. And recent estimates are the number for 2016 will top 60,000 deaths. Just an astounding number of victims being impacted by this crisis.
Against the backdrop of that information, the White House held a recent opioid summit in which the president acknowledged that the problem is getting worse, but wouldn't go so far as to call it a national emergency.
The president has suggested a sort of just say no approach and doing more on the criminal enforcement side were two strategies that the president was endorsing. This approach varies widely from the recommendations of his own specially appointed commission on combating drug addiction, which includes several state governors recommending further expansion of Medicaid as a way to allocate resources where they can do the most good on handling addiction treatment.
Well, one of the biggest problems that frontline clinicians face in battling the opioid crisis, Mark, is the lack of available resources to get those suffering from substance abuse disorder into the kind of treatment that can help them. So it's not clear from the president's statements whether those resources will be forthcoming anytime soon, and I guess we just have to wait and see.
Speaking of allocating health resources, Margaret, our guest today is on a quest to disrupt the enormous amount of resources being spent on healthcare in the country.
Dave Chase is a longtime health entrepreneur and venture capitalist in the healthcare space who recently launched a nonprofit entity to promote value-based solutions to the high cost of healthcare. He's also got a new book, The CEO's Guide to Restoring the American Dream, How to Deliver World-Class Healthcare to Your Employees at Half the Cost. So we look forward to that conversation, Mark.
Lori Robertson also stops by. She's the managing editor of factcheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter because we love hearing from you. Now we'll get to our interview with Dave Chase in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. When pharmaceutical giant Merck's CEO Kenneth Frazier resigned his post on the president's business council, he incurred a swift Twitter stream of wrath. The president threatening to get even with Mr. Frazier by now, having more time to lower rip-off drug prices, quote, "It brings up an interesting question, though. Where are those drug price hikes coming from? According to a report in Kaiser Health News, Merck is far from alone in acceleration of drug prices, which have risen steadily across the spectrum of existing medications. And according to the report, it is costing Medicaid billions of dollars. Kaiser's analysis of more than 300 commonly prescribed drugs, which have long been on the market, saw spikes in prices in 2015 and 2016, costing Medicaid programs an additional $3.2 billion last year. For instance, the common painkiller naproxen, sold under the brand name Aleve, went up 136% in 1 year. Commonly prescribed antipsychotic drug to treat schizophrenia went up almost 350% in 1 year. And it's not just drug consumers on the Medicaid rolls paying more. Consumers in the commercial market are paying more as well, according to the Kaiser report. Meanwhile, a new service being paid for by Medicare is seeing quite an uptick in its first year of use. According to another Kaiser Health News analysis, 2016 was the first year Medicare began paying for end-of-life care discussions, utilizing a tool that allows families to discuss and plan what kinds of long-term care interventions they wish to seek for their loved ones. Proponents say it's filling an important gap in elder care, aligning a patient's personal wishes with the actions of the institutions treating them at the end of their lives. Clinicians often aren't well trained to broach the subject with patients, and patients may have far different views than their family members about what kinds of interventions they want. Medicare reimburses clinicians for the initial facilitated discussion as well as additional follow-up consultations. While the president has declared the opioid crisis a national emergency, he hasn't said exactly what kinds of additional resources will be allocated to combat the deadly scourge, now the leading cause of accidental death in this country. A number of states have sued the makers of the highly addictive opioid OxyContin, Purdue Pharma. South Carolina is the latest state to file a suit claiming the company heavily marketed the drug, knowing it was far more addictive than they let on to clinicians. Purdue and other drug makers have been sued over opioid products by Oklahoma, Mississippi, Ohio, Missouri, New Hampshire. A group of states' attorneys general in June announced an investigation into the role played by pharmaceutical manufacturers in the opioid epidemic. And the state of Oregon has become the fifth in the nation to raise the legal age to purchase cigarettes to 21. Oregon's governor signing the legislation saying while smoking rates have come down, tobacco consumption is still the leading cause of preventable death in this country, upwards of 540,000 people per year. In a 2015 study, the Institute of Medicine determined raising the smoking age to 21 nationally would ultimately save 250,000 lives among Americans born after the year 2000. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dave Chase, co-founder and CEO of Health Rosetta Institute, a nonprofit organization seeking to reduce healthcare costs by addressing root dysfunctions in healthcare. He's executive producer of The Big Heist, a satirical film that exposes the profit-driven healthcare system in the United States. He's also healthcare transformer in residence at Startup Health. Mr. Chase served as global industry director for Microsoft from 1993 to 2001, a prolific writer and contributor in health finance. Mr. Chase's latest book is The CEO's Guide to Restoring the American Dream, How to Deliver World-Class Healthcare to Your Employees at Half the Cost. Dave, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, and congratulations on your new book, The CEO's Guide to Restoring the American Dream. And for most employers, providing healthcare is by far the greatest financial burden. And so what you're proposing, providing quality care at half the cost, sounds too good to be true. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners what kind of disruptions will it take in healthcare to bring us closer to that lofty goal?
Number one, it's about, in terms of the tools, it's really about the team and resources. Internally, you have to recognize that this is an important area. There's a private equity firm we talked with where the first discussion they have with the CEO of a company they've acquired is, how's your healthcare business? And they'll get a puzzled look and then say, how is your $42 million healthcare business? And then the light bulb goes on. Mm-hmm. Wow, this is the second biggest cost for most companies after payroll. And often the individual responsible for it is overwhelmed with a lot of other tasks, isn't necessarily best suited for it. And then the other piece of it that is probably the most powerful role that almost nobody knows about in healthcare is the benefit consultant or broker. You may remember stockbrokers that, largely went the way of the dodo bird because of conflicts of interest and lack mm-hmm. of disclosure. Mm-hmm. Well, that's today's benefits brokers. Now, the smart ones, smart stockbrokers, reinvented themselves as financial and wealth advisors, and that's what really is starting to happen in healthcare. There's just staggering conflicts of interest and lack of disclosure. One of the crazy things is the worst job they do, the more they get paid in mm-hmm. many cases. Healthcare costs go up, they actually get more money. And so the tool we have is a blueprint for how to purchase healthcare smart. We have that up at healthrosetta.org. And we've put all our focus in identifying the great benefits advisors. So that's really the most important tool, is working with the right folks.
Well, Dave, certainly we would all agree that healthcare has certainly been seeing some dramatic change and innovation. Some of it is in the digitization of information and electronic health records, but we just have so many issues within healthcare around quality. We have clinicians who report high levels of burnout. But you say there's a renaissance looming in healthcare. So what are the essential hallmarks of this, what you call the Health 3.0 vision that you have, and what's the roadmap that you think will get us there?
Well, I think it's a paradigm that really transcends both 1.0 and 2.0. We're preserving their strengths, those good things in terms of the relationships that we're in kind of healthcare 1.0, and technology can add value, kind of the hallmark of 2.0. while allowing, for the emergence of something far greater, more of a repersonalized care that honors both the unique individual. And Health 3.0 is really about the connections and the primacy of human relationships. It's really about a partnership with our patients that can only emerge when clinicians have the time and space to understand the unique hopes, dreams, and fears of the individual in front of them, while also recognizing that they don't operate in a vacuum. So the focus in Health 3.0 is on actual outcomes, not the kind of click box quality measurements that often don't actually measure quality, and where clinicians are given the tools and autonomy to achieve the outcomes that matter to their patients. You know, being able to do the right thing and let technology work in the background. Think of it as Health 3.0, you're evidence empowered, not evidence enslaved. And there's that mutual accountability between the patient and the caregiver. The way we think it can come into being is these organizations kind of bottom up, focused in on the quadruple aim, which is better patient experience, better outcomes, lower costs. But what I've found is the organizations that are achieving the triple aim on a sustained basis are focused in on the fourth and often forgotten aim, that caring for the care team. And we think that the biggest missed opportunity is the 22 million public sector workers. The health benefits they're getting are just as bad as the private sector, and both publicly paid and privately paid systems are wildly underperforming, with terrible pricing failure and horrific rates of overtreatment. You know, things like back pain or the way that we deal with end of life just are not up to snuff. You know, it's kind of put up or shut up time. And unfortunately, a lot of what's going on in D.C. is just shifting deck chairs on the healthcare Titanic. So we look at state and municipal workers as a great test bed. Follow the lead of what places like the city of Milwaukee or the city of Kirkland or Pittsburgh area schools. And what you find is the best way to slash healthcare costs is to improve benefits. And that's what Health 3.0 does.
You know, I'm thinking about millennials. And, you know, millennials have decided that the largest automobile company is Uber. It's decided that the largest hotel business in the world is Airbnb. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if the largest healthcare company in the world will be more data-driven. It seems to me that what we're seeing with the whole computational health science world is probably going to inform how healthcare is delivered. Just wondering about really the transformation that you're envisioning if you look back 10 years and see what's happened in both of those industries, and isn't that about to happen in healthcare?
I think so, and I think that a lot of people don't realize that millennials are the largest generation in history, and they now make up the largest chunk of the workforce, whether it's things like social media or smartphones or better food. You know, so-called big food and big soda have had their worst earnings recently and attributed to millennials doing different. You know, I sort of joke that in a lot of ways our existing healthcare system is designed perfectly for millennials if you do the exact opposite of what we've been doing. and you're right. I mean, there'll be bricks and mortar for sure. But there are organizations, you know, some that are already visible, like Clover Health, that's a new Medicare Advantage player, that is kind of that model where they're really data enabled, but they also realize they need to use that as a tool to support the overall care team. You know, it's not the technology tail, you know, wagging the dog. And having a technology framework that's very agile, because this isn't the shop floor scenario of old. You know, if you have a static production line factory, you know, putting in something that's quite static, and a lot of the legacy electronic, you know, health record systems are, you know, a monumental task to customize and implement, but then they become quite rigid. And when you've got 80% of what we're spending in the issues around chronic disease, and you look at the organizations that are doing a terrific job, and one that I'm quite familiar with, a company called Iora Health, you know, one of these quadruple aim focused organizations achieving great results with patient population. They got the care process right before they really focused in on applying technology. And then we think about lifestyle diseases, chronic diseases. So they have a model really brings in health coaches. And that's, again, where the best way to interact with certainly millennials oftentimes is phone, email, text, whatever.
Well, I want to talk about your latest in a long series of very interesting ventures. You recently co-founded the Health Rosetta Institute, which you created as an open source guide, I understand, for making more value-based decisions. And one of the keys to Health Rosetta Institute's approach is a certification process similar to LEED certification for environmental buildings, share with our readers a little bit about the origins of the Health Rosetta Institute and what are you hoping to achieve with it?
So probably any startup is about finding some market gap. And so I thought, well, I'm going to just go study the organizations who've already are living the value and outcomes-based model. And because they're on the leading edge, of course, there's not going to be off-the-shelf software for them yet. And so that's where I found organizations like Iora Health. These were the organizations that really cracked the code. And, you know, the great news is, you know, what we say on our site is healthcare is fixed. We're just scaling the fixes. But the thing that was really frustrating was I was amazed these people that I thought it was their job to know these things had not even heard of things like direct primary care or Iora Health and some really amazingly successful models. And I realized the knowledge sharing is quite poor often in healthcare. It's kind of this tribal knowledge. Maybe it shares in this little circle. You know, I thought about for a lot of people, healthcare is indecipherable. I thought about the Rosetta Stone, which decoded the seemingly indecipherable Egyptian hieroglyphics. And so I was like, I'm just going to put a name to it. And kind of one thing led to another, thinking about analogies like LEED that took green building. You know, you think about the built infrastructure, it's sort of like healthcare. It's very entrenched. You don't fix that overnight. But LEED took sustainable building practices from a fringe concept 20 years ago to a marketing advantage for developers 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of lessons you can learn from things like LEED and even fair trade and other stuff like that that we've modeled the Health Rosetta Institute after.
We're speaking today with Dave Chase, co-founder and CEO of the Health Rosetta Institute, a nonprofit organization seeking to reduce healthcare costs by addressing root dysfunctions. Dave, let's talk about your work supporting other innovators and startups in this incredibly shifting healthcare landscape. And we've had guests like Esther Dyson, who've been on with us in the past, who say the tough thing about healthcare innovation is that it takes a long-term view in terms of getting these results. And so I'm wondering if you would share with our listeners your work as a transformer in residence at Startup Health. Then what type of ventures are most likely to capture your attention?
I view myself as a kind of skeptical empiricist. And I just look at what's actually working, who's gotten the process right, and then applied technology. Always applying the quadruple aim filter. You know, we're just simply not going to invest in something that doesn't positively move all of those filters, you know, an improved care team experience, improved patient experience, improved outcome, and lower cost. You know, historically, it's been a good bet from an investor perspective to assume that there's perpetual hyperinflation in healthcare. But what we've seen is there are opportunities in deflationary economics. And so we've made investments where there's rethought care delivery models, rethought plan models. You know, direct contracting and direct care is an interesting area where it dramatically simplifies the payment mechanisms. And you still need to verify eligibility, but it can, you know, reduce dramatically the steps. So we invested in a company called Hint Health that does stuff like that. Another organization called Robin Care that's focused in around the cancer journey. Of course, there's stuff being done on the clinical side of that, but the fact is the family members and how you navigate that whole journey has a profound impact on the outcomes. And so they've demonstrated great evidence of how they can really help improve the outcomes in oncology. And I mentioned Clover Health is another one where they are really rethinking what it is to be a technology-enabled plan. And so their ability to test new care models and new innovations, I mean, their cycle times to test stuff is at least one order of magnitude faster than most traditional health plans. So you need to have this ability to really quickly iterate stuff. So we like those type of organizations that have proven themselves and are really supporting that the human level, but empowered by technology.
Well, Dave, we've just experienced a dramatic showdown over health reform in Congress, and still so much uncertainty looming over how government is going to continue to support things like the Medicaid expansion and subsidy supports for low-wage earners. And I think you've called the recent repeal and replace efforts a wasted opportunity. So share with us what you'd like to see on the government side of the healthcare equation.
In terms of the role of the government, do we think of them as a payer and we think of them as a policymaker? And they certainly are those things. The two areas that don't get enough attention, which is where I would encourage people, one I mentioned, if you look at advanced battery technology and a lot of green technology, they got their start in, you know, the Defense Department and federal, you know, organizations that really served as a market accelerator. And so the public sector are huge purchasers of healthcare, and unfortunately are just as bad as most of the rest of the system. And so that is a huge opportunity where I would encourage them to focus. And then the other is a lot of the public health and social determinants of health. You know, generally it's agreed less than 20% of health outcomes are driven by the traditional healthcare system. You know, the other 80% are driven by social and economic factors, health behaviors, and the physical environment. And you think about something like Medicaid, there are things that may not have traditionally been thought of in terms of healthcare that can have a huge impact on outcomes. There's foundations like the Ripple Foundation of this Rethink Health framework, where there's a lot of proven, well-documented, evidence-based approaches to improve outcomes. I think 60% of Medicaid hospitalizations are preventable and avoidable. And so we can prevent some of those and, you know, get a higher and better value, and it's much better at the bottom line level as well. And so a lot of focus could go there.
That's great. You know, Dave, I was thinking as you were talking about what drives your investment strategy, and you sort of said that, you know, what's working. I was thinking what's working is the healthcare in Western Europe. They are getting better outcomes on every indice that's being rated. Certainly cost is a big issue here in the United States. 1/6 of the GDP is taken up by healthcare. And I'm always wondering, if you could get those outcomes, would this cost that we pay be worth it? I wonder about the dislocation that will happen if we take $1 trillion out of the health system. So as you think about this transformation that you're talking about, talk to me about how do you improve health without creating massive employment disruption?
No question, with the aging population, there's going to be an ever-growing need for clinicians. Where we've seen a lot of the growth has been on the administrative side that really hasn't helped outcomes. And the part that tends to get forgotten is healthcare is unique in that it's the only industry in the last 20 years that hasn't seen a productivity gain. And when you look at the impact that healthcare has had, it's been devastating on the economy. There was a segment on NPR recently called Make America Make Again. It was about bringing manufacturing jobs back. They asked the CEO of a, you know, small manufacturer in New Jersey, you know, what she thought of this. And she's like, well, when my father owned this business, healthcare costs were less than 5% of the compensation package. And we have roles where 30 to 50% of their entire compensation is going to healthcare. We feel it, and that's holding back jobs, you know, incredibly. Companies have moved jobs to Canada, not because it's a low-wage place, but because the healthcare costs have gotten out of control. So it's important to recognize that that's been a massive drain. And so I think there can be a managed transition, but I think we underestimate how much can be unlocked if we actually get high value. And, you know, there's been some articles recently about the opioid crisis and the devastating impact on local economies, and how these companies have tons of open jobs, but they can't fill them because 40% of the applicants test positive for typically opioids. And, you know, that's a crisis almost entirely of the making of the healthcare industry. So we have to take that into account in that calculus as well.
We've been speaking today with Dave Chase, healthcare venture capitalist, entrepreneur, and co-founder and CEO of the Health Rosetta Institute, a nonprofit organization that seeks to reduce healthcare costs by addressing root dysfunctions in healthcare. You can learn more about this work by going to healthrosetta.org or follow him on Twitter at ChaseDave. Dave, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
I really appreciated being on.
At Conversations on Healthcare. We want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
We've seen a few ads this summer warning of deep cuts to Medicare that could, they say, affect access to doctors. The ads are referring to the Independent Payment Advisory Board, a board that has faced controversy since it was created by the Affordable Care Act in 2010. Listeners may recall former VP nominee Sarah Palin referring to the board as a, quote, death panel back then. But so far, no one has been appointed to this board, and it hasn't done anything. The Affordable Care Act called for a 15-member board made up of healthcare experts appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate as a way to slow the growth of Medicare spending. The board hasn't been needed because Medicare spending growth has remained below targets set by the ACA that would trigger IPAB action. And the latest report by the Medicare trustees says the IPAB isn't expected to be triggered until 2021. Here's how it works. The actuary for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services estimates per capita Medicare growth, and each year those estimates are published in a report from the Medicare trustees. The IPAB determination looks at a five-year projected average of per capita growth and compares that to the target growth, which has been tied to inflation, but next year switches to GDP plus 1 percentage point. If projected Medicare spending would exceed the target, the IPAB must recommend ways to keep growth below the savings target established by the actuary. If there's no board, the Secretary of Health and Human Services would make the recommendation. The cuts would then be implemented 2 years after being triggered, though Congress can choose to implement its own changes to keep spending below the target. Last year, the trustees' report estimated that IPAB would be triggered in 2017 for the first time, but it turned out growth remained below the targets. Now the trustees estimate the IPAB won't be triggered until 2021. We can't predict what cuts IPAB could make in the future, but the board is limited in what it can do. It can't increase beneficiaries' premiums or cost sharing or restrict benefits, though it could reduce payments to healthcare providers. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Of the roughly 4 million women who give birth annually in the United States, a quarter of them retain at least 10 pounds gained during their pregnancy. And these women are also more likely to add weight during the first postpartum year. Those numbers go up significantly for African American, Hispanic, and low-income women.
Something about weight retention during this period after having a baby that increases lifetime risk of health problems, cardiovascular disease, and metabolic problems. So regardless of how much a woman gains during pregnancy, weight gain during this period is a kind of independent risk factor, we call it.
California Polytechnic Institute researcher Dr. Suzanne Phelan wondered if a customized intervention designed around the Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women as well as the Women, Infants, and Children Nutrition Program might help such women shed postpartum weight.
You see about 30% dropout, and it's no surprise because women during the postpartum period, they're busy with their baby, they've got this erratic, unpredictable schedule.
Her team designed a website with features such as weekly lessons, a web diary, instructional videos, text messages. 12 clinics were randomized to the WIC program or the standard care group, or the WIC program plus, the 12-month primarily internet-based weight loss program. And the results were significant. More women with the internet intervention, 57%, lost weight than the WIC participants alone, 36%. Dr. Phelan says that even though the weight loss amount seems relatively small, the loss translates into a statistically lower risk of later weight gain and the long-term risk for related health issues such as diabetes and heart disease that accompany it. A low-cost, guided online nutrition and weight loss support program designed for women receiving SNAP and WIC benefits, empowering them with additional tools to lose that nagging baby weight so many women struggle with. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.